You are now listening to the Someone's Favorite Productions podcast network.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, I'm McCordy. No? Two on the nose? Okay, all right.
This episode is already a hate crime.
Okay, let me try this one, I guess. Maybe this will be a little bit better. On top of spaghetti, all covered with cheese, I lost my poor meatball when somebody sneezed. It rolled off the table and onto the floor.
Oh, no. Oh,
and then my dear meatball went right out the door. Oh. That reminds me of growing up and watching my meatball roll away when someone sneezed. Goodness, what a memory. Join me, won't you? And think of your own memories, and we can share them together. They don't need to make sense. Just string them together as you think of them. I'll follow along. Because after all, it's foreign film February, so I would expect nothing less. Music.
The New World Pictures podcast, where we're going to talk about every movie released by New World Pictures. I'm Ryan. With me, as always, is Mark.
I know we're not at final questions, but this won an Academy Award?
And Erica.
I think I speak for everybody here when I say, I want a woman.
And we are in the midst of Foreign Film February 2, where we talk about all the foreign films released by New World Pictures. And this one's a doozy, so of course we had to turn to one of our favorite guests. She's been having to really go through...
A doozy enthusy! A top doozy enthusy! I'm a New World Pictures Zuzi, if you know what I mean.
She's winner of, I think, the guest who has watched some of the worst movies right. we've ever
she's
talked
been,
about on this
I was
going to
say, she has been through the trenches with us as we have gone through this.
There are people in trenches right now that would not want to trade.
They would be like, oh, I'm good. I don't need to see up from the depths. So I'm just going to stay right here on the front lines. But she is a writer, she's a performer, she's a national treasure. Allie Davis, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. Abordanza.
You know, when I told you about this particular one, I thought, you know what, let's throw Allie a bone here.
A bone,
let's give her something that is
not just a bone, but a masterpiece.
Yeah.
Let's give her something that's like, you know, hey, you know, we've really put you through it. We've tested your patience enough. And I turned it on and I started 10 minutes in and I was like, oh, I hope Dally's okay. I don't know. And then I saw, oh, this is 2 hours long. Like, okay, well, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was about the same time that I also looked at the length and went, oh, wow. Yeah,
I did the same thing. At the 10-minute mark, I was like, they got me. They got me.
Sorry, Allie. Just sorry, Allie, again.
I don't know.
Sorry. At least you got 1.5 gigantic boobies.
Right. Is
that... Yeah. Yeah.
The boobies and some trust issues. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, you get used to a lot of the movies that we talk about are like 90 minutes or less. So
right. This is going to be a quick 86. Yeah.
I'll do a couple quick viewings, got, you know, three hours or so, and then I can move on with my life. And it's like, no, you got to put some time in. Mm-hmm. Of course, we're talking about 1973's Armorcord.
And really, listen to that 1973, because there's some key information in that date in terms of what's acceptable and what is considered funny that maybe isn't anymore. Mm-hmm.
Let's listen to the trailer, and just know in advance, I actually cut a full minute out. So just know that.
Oh, the trailer's not 2 hours long either? Weird. That's weird. Yeah.
Federico Fellini, Amarcord. Fellini remembers the 1930s. Maker of La Dolce Vita, 8.5, and Satyricon, comes a new masterwork. The new Fellini. Amarcord.
That's right, 1973's Amarcord. Why are we being sold this movie as if we've walked into a back alley?
Hey, I got the Fellini. Hey, you want a Fellini?
But it's brought to you by the one guy who drives his motorcycle up and down your street. You know what time it is. It's time for that one guy to drive his motorcycle up and down your street. Or is it? He does it all the time, day or night. Keep your wits about you, because you know at some point when you least expect it, the guy who drives his motorcycle up and down the street is going to drive his motorcycle up and down your street.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah. As the trailer told you, this is directed by Federico Fellini, the director of 8.5 and La Dolce Vita. Though I should have said it, the director of 8.5 and La Dolce Vita. Like the trailer. I mean, as if it was sinister.
It's a Fellini.
It's a Fellini. Like it's hot. Like it's hot merchandise. All right. Anyway, he had just finished 1972's Roma. It was a semi-autobiographical movie about his life after he had moved to Rome. This movie is actually something that came to him.
That makes sense. That's an appropriate title.
It does make sense.
It makes sense if he's moving to Rome or if it's about the little tomatoes, you know, either way.
Right.
That would make sense.
Just a guy who's passionate about growing tomatoes. This one, though, it came to him in 1967. He was actually in the hospital and he thought he was dying, and he started thinking of his youth growing up in Rimini, Italy. And that's when he got the inspiration to do this movie. As he told Charlotte Chandler in her book, I, Fellini. That's right. I bought a book to talk about this movie. And he said,
what's the return policy on that book? You know?
He said this. He said, people who live in several towns, cities, countries, and have feelings for all of them always have a small piece of themselves in some other place. All of me is in one place, Rome. It could be said that there is something to me in Rimini, but I don't think so. I took Rimini away with me, and now it's the Rimini I remember. A place people who live there now wouldn't recognize if they could look into my mind. Armacord is the look into the world of my memory.
So let me get this straight. He had just made a movie about where he was living currently. Then he decided to make a movie about his childhood. Was there like Fellini the college years that he made after that?
I mean, or... I think that's kind of Roma because this is the college years. This is after Saved by the Bell went on to college and they were too old to play high schoolers.
Right.
So that was Roma.
Did he ever get to his Golden Girls version where he was living in assisted living with three other people?
Yeah, and... I mean, I think later in his career, maybe.
Oh, okay.
Speaking of too old to play high schoolers.
Yeah. About 75% of the class, I believe.
But, 47 years old.
Yeah. But this movie had an interesting beginning because Fellini told the Chronicle News Service in 1973 that the film was originally titled The Profaned Man. And he says, quote, it was the picture of a poor fellow totally conditioned by the false and proper information of his era. Now the story is changing. I'm not a director who limits himself to the original scenario. I would say that's a giant change from what we experience in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
He says at the moment, and this is the article speaking, he likens the main character to an old man in the year 2000, turning the pages of his diary and trying to describe life in a little Italian town to a young interviewer who may not even be listening. If he had a more active narrator, he abandoned that too. So he really was untethered. And this movie is untethered by any and all structural or ideas that you could possibly have. It's unmoored by plot and by story. It is.
Yeah.
This is a man who had a few films in a row, hailed as masterpieces, and he was like, oh, I can get away with a lot.
Just kidding. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what, Allie? What is your history with Fellini? I mean, how you? I imagine you've seen some of his other films.
God, if I have, it's been years. Decades since I've seen La Dolce Vita. The weird thing is, there's a scene with four young men in a car that I did
in this
at
film.
Some point in this film, as like a kid or like a teenager, I was like flipping through channels at one point, and that must have been on HBO or something. And so I remember that scene because I was like, the fuck is this?
Yeah.
That did not stay to find out.
just so that you could keep that memory in your head and then decades later go, what the fuck is this?
Oh, that's what that was.
Once you saw it in full context, you were still like, you're like, I don't.
Bookmark what? This brain, because future me is going to get to dive in on this one.
Keep that neuron ready. Yes.
Okay, well, here's where you can watch Armacord.
Armacord.
You can watch it on the Criterion Channel. It is on HBO Max. That's all at the time of this recording. You can also buy the Criterion Blu-ray. Well, let's talk about what this movie is about. Mark, what is
Armacord
about?
This movie, oddly, it surprised me because it's about fart jokes, dick jokes, and the fact that teenage boys are the fucking worst. That's pretty much it. I mean, I could go deeper into boys are always horny. They think that the height of hilarity is poo and pee. You know, we'll get into the car scene, so you know, we'll save that for later.
Well, we've already gotten into it, but yeah,
they will jerk off with each other in a car in close quarters, very close quarters, and as tough as they are at school, around the neighborhood throwing fucking snowballs, like pummeling people with snowballs at the first opportunity. The minute one of them gets cold, they turn into the biggest whiny little bitch about it.
Accurate,
teenage
honestly.
Boys.
Very accurate. The worst, for sure. Allie, what is this movie about?
Okay, so it's got an overarching theme, but then it does have a message that drives through, which is, so the theme is that I think that people yearn for change, but actually don't change very much. And in its own way, that is beautiful. The message is Daddy Fellini likes butts.
And he, you know what? And he cannot lie.
He cannot lie.
He's a butt man.
Yeah.
He's a butt man. Mm-hmm. If there's one thing I learned in this movie, is Fellini was a butt man.
Erica, what is this movie about?
I thought this movie was just a Wes Anderson Italian film, right?
That's a really good description.
This is a 1930s made in the 1970s Wes Anderson, right? Doesn't make any sense. It's colorful. It's interesting to look at. The characters are quirky. But what's going on? Couldn't tell you. Could not tell you.
If you took Richard Linklater's Slacker,
added a little bit
of plot,
yeah,
and then took Woody Allen's Radio Days and took away some plot, you have this movie there in the middle.
I actually thought, Mark, my thought was this was Slacker, because I definitely thought Slacker, but I was like, this is like Local Hero and Slacker kind of thrown into the same, and like, you take like the listlessness of like Slacker and just marry it to like a small town, but and just eradicate plot. And
how
it's just
dare
kinda...
you fucking throw Local Hero?
No. I'm talking about this movie. No,
it had a plot.
Saying. No,
Brian,
Local Hero
they were
has a
going
plot.
To build. They were going to build an oil refinery. This was a plot.
Local Hero is a plot. We, you and I are total Local Hero stands. Don't get me wrong. Don't get it twisted.
Also, if you took Alan Alda's The Four Seasons and removed all the plot.
just kept one butt. Your favorite butt.
Then we got it.
Yeah, teenage boys have weird fetishes. Yours was Four Seasons.
I cannot deny that. It was. And I'm proud
this,
of it. I'm proud
this,
of proud
what
of
I thought this movie's about was two things. One is, I thought it was like as if you wrote your lifelong diary in a three-ring binder and then you opened it up with a strong breeze and it just blew everywhere and then you had to like reassemble it and you tried to read through it again. You're like, I don't know. This stuff is just seeming to come in and we're all over the map here.
Mm-hmm. I know we're not at final questions, but it was one of the things that I kind of loved about this movie. Mm. That it was chaotic, and it felt very relatable to me. Like, if somebody was like, hey, think about where you grew up, I'd be like, well, there was this time, and then this, and then this, and then this,
yeah,
and then this.
Yeah,
yeah, so,
The other thing I thought this movie was about was that you have to go through a lot to get a free cigarette.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, sometimes you get rewarded.
I mean, I'm not saying there isn't rewards along the way. I'm just saying you go through a lot. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm just going to say, if he had followed simple instructions, they both would have had a lovely evening and he would have had a cigarette.
Let me rephrase. Sometimes on your way to get a cigarette, you have a side quest. And that side quest is to... I feel bad for him. Ryan and I were talking about this a little bit before you guys jumped on, that this was his first exposure to brastuses in his face.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I mean, he had a tall mountain to climb. That's a lot. It was a lot for him to take in.
An honor and a privilege.
I agree. I agree with you.
1,000%.
But I understood him being a little overwhelmed with the situation.
It's a lot for your first at bat.
Yeah, you don't normally do, your first at bat is normally not a knuckleball.
Yeah, right. So. If you are in Little League, it's like if you step up on like T-ball, and all of a sudden you've got a major league pitcher at the mound. You're like, wait, this isn't fair. I thought I was just supposed to just hit it off the stick. They're like, no. It's you know. Anyway. All right, let's turn to good old trusty Letterboxd. We're on Letterboxd, so give us a follow there if you'd like. In an Italian seaside town, so far so good. Yes, mm-hmm. That's true.
Yes.
Young Tita gets into trouble with his friends and watches various local eccentrics as they engage in often absurd behavior. I'm sorry. I couldn't get through that because I've not read this before, and that is no. I mean, I guess, but also no.
Yeah.
All right. Frequently clashing with his stern father, yes, mm-hmm. and defended by his doting mother, sure.
Somewhat, okay.
Just a loving mother, let's say.
Yeah.
I didn't say any doting, yeah.
Yeah, I would agree.
Tita witnesses the actions of a wide range of characters. Again, they're just trying to figure out how do you explain this movie. I get it, Letterboxd. I understand where you're coming from. It's tough.
There's a tree, and then there's some... a guy with a cart.
There's a car chase. And then there's
snow
a big,
happens.
There's an ocean liner that comes by. It's a lot. There's a lot.
I don't know. There's a hotel. I don't know why why we deal with it. A
couple of dream sequences. Yeah.
All the construction workers are poets. It's a lot to take on.
It's a lot.
Fox should have just said, "Do you like Wes Anderson and making your own through lines?" Emmercord! Do you like connecting the dots on your own? Emmercord! Also, am I pronouncing it right? Not really sure!
Well, it's interesting that the title itself is basically from the region that he grew up. That's how they say "I remember." So that is not exactly how you say it in Italian, but how you say it, I guess, apparently in the language of that area. That's how they say "I remember," which is interesting for a movie that he wrote with another human being. But anyway, seems a little...
Sometimes people need help remembering stuff.
Yeah.
Jeez Louise.
Yeah.
You know this, Ryan, all the time. I'm like, "Ryan, it was that guy in that movie and that thing, and we did that," and you're like, "Yeah, that was, you know..."
And I say what I usually say, "Give me some more context clues, and we'll figure this out." okay, so he witnesses the actions of a wide range of characters, from his extended family to fascist loyalists to sensual women, with certain moments shifting into fantastical scenarios.
Fantastical scenarios?
I would say the harem sequence is fantastical.
That, okay, I agree with you. But wouldn't we then say fantastical scenario?
You know, I've had in my days as a freelance writer those times when you're like, 500 words, okay, and you write it up and you're like, "Looks good, let's send it." Wait, how many words is it? 250. Okay. What else can I add? I gotta double this thing, and I've already said what I had to say. Fantastical scenarios.
I mean, I guess we could take like the 6 feet of snow in Coastal Italy as maybe a memory that's been, I don't know, man.
Yeah, no, I'm with you.
Those poor guys that start shoveling the streets,
they had a squad so ready for shoveling the snow in Italy. What is...
And apparently all they did was just like, "Well, let's just form these giant glaciers around this round town." That's all they did, just to carve out so we could all walk, and this one guy can ride his motorcycle.
Conversely, though, at the beginning of the movie, they have a giant fire in the piazza, and after it's all burned, it's one old woman in a tiny little fireplace shovel trying to shovel this thing up.
Yeah.
So the thing that they do every year, they're ill prepared for, but that random snowfall, the worst in history, they are on top of it. Fantastical scenarios right there. There's two more.
Yeah, that beginning scenario where they burn a witch in effigy, which I just took as local Italian seaside Burning Man.
It's to celebrate St. Joseph's Day, Ryan.
I mean, I didn't like that sequence, but I would go there before actual Burning Man. Absolutely.
Yeah. As somebody who has been to Burning Man, I would say, yeah, definitely. I would rather go burn an old chair.
And that one guy who they hilariously wouldn't let down.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The jokes.
Look at this guy. We're going to burn him alive. Isn't this hilarious? That's a lot of this humor, though. It does set you up really well for the type of jokes. Even if it does also say something about the character of that particular character, which is Tita's uncle, who is also a sympathizer to, like, the fascists. And also is made up to be one of these characters in Italian culture, apparently, that are, like, there was a word for them, but I don't recall what it is. Because it's in Italian and I don't speak it, but that they had a word for guys that, like, would just live at home for long stretches of time and never really got jobs and just kind of were pampered, which is what his uncle is.
Freeloader?
Well, we have words for them too, Mark, yes.
Oh, I just didn't know if you didn't know any words. I didn't know if you knew, like, if that's what you were saying.
I'm just asking for any word at all to describe this guy.
Oh, okay.
Also, just to say that opening two, we do begin with spring and we have all the puffballs in the air, which to me was a nightmare living in Chicago. I was always like, I'm in for it for the next few weeks. I will not be able to breathe. And it's how the movie kind of opens and closes with those little puffballs in the air. As we said, this is kind of like a lot. I think we've made that point clear. So let's go through our different characters and about stuff that's going on with them rather than going through the entirety of this movie, because it would be a lot. We have already mentioned poor Tita. He's kind of our main character, sort of.
Kind, yeah.
A main character that you are, throughout the film, attempting to reject and look for another. But he keeps showing up, so you're like, I guess this is the guy.
I guess it's you, yeah.
Yeah. And as Mark's pointed out, he's in a particular stage in his life when he is just the worst, and a lot of people were the worst at that age. Not all of us, but a lot of us, and so I guess that's what he's trying to capture. Now, he's played by newcomer Bruno Zanon in his debut role. He's chosen out of thousands of hopefuls for the role. But Fellini based this on a childhood friend who also went by the name Tita, and also had a father who was known for his outbursts. And in fact, on the Criterion Blu-ray, they interview the real Tita, who says that Fellini actually had offered him the role of the father for the movie, but he ended up not being able to do it. But that he was like, only you would know the crazy outbursts of your father. Who better to play him than you?
Plus, he didn't have a giant mole on the top of his head like the actor who played his father, so that would have required extra time in the makeup chair.
It's a lot of extra time, yeah.
That would have thrown the budget totally out of whack, so, I mean, I can understand it.
Back to Tita. He's in school. We were talking about how he's in school, and as we go through his school with all the different teachers, it's like this film has, like, giant sections that it goes through, and it's like, we're just going to go through all the class stuff now, all the school stuff. Remember school? Here's all the school stuff with all of our different teachers.
Will we get just a representative couple of teachers, or should we do all the teachers?
All of the teachers.
We can always cut it back later, but let's just do all the teachers. That way we'll just have it. We'll have it ready.
No PE. That was a...
That was the value of the fascists, apparently, was to do their gymnastics or whatever, their little hoops. And
you're right, to get their exercise, yeah, to true, be strong.
That's true, that's right.
Well, we had a foreign exchange student live with us from Italy, and she told us that, and I found it interesting, this movie, because it kind of follows suit. She was very surprised going to U.S. high schools because, for one, you have multiple classes a day, and you actually... you walk from class to class. And in Italy, they have multiple classes a day, but you never leave your seat. The teacher leaves and another teacher comes in. You also don't have a lunch break. You have a 15-minute break to get a snack. And that's it. You're in your seat the entire day. So there isn't PE or anything like that. It's just, you just are taught all day in the same room by different teachers.
No wonder they're going crazy. I want to be clear real quick that I do not think fascists add value. That was a
circle. Oh, no, thank you.
Thank you for clarifying, because I was ready to hang up. I
was somebody ready to walk away. Somebody was like, unsubscribe.
Bro, I didn't mean, you know, on the bright side. I was...
But yeah, they beat fascism, and they were at least went away from it, and the result was no PE.
Right. But they did have P, and I didn't get to ask my exchange student if she had ever constructed a paper P tube so that they could just pee somewhere in the classroom.
Yeah. That's more of a boy thing, but you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I think if you're going to limit your imagination, sure. I mean,
it could have been done. I feel like I missed an important part of high school because we never
engineers. We need you. I mean, how do we construct this so that it is for both boys and girls? Also, by the time that you collapse that long thing, which he does very quickly, like, there's pee all over you.
Right. Who drew the short straw and has to collapse the
pee? Who has to, like, close it all up and bring it back to the... Because the guy who's peeing is not doing it. So somebody's just got piss all over their hands that's not theirs. And then they have to sit there and pretend like they've done nothing, but they've got... They smell this piss. It's like burning their nostrils. It's
plus to have just the right amount of pee at the ready seems complicated. But I don't know. Maybe they practiced.
It does. I also feel bad. Whoever inserted himself into the pee tube, there's no way you did that cleanly either. There's going to be some backspray. There's going to be...
Oh, yeah. He smells of pee, too. Like, if you were to do an investigation on who peed in class... And if you were going to just stop by, I see a puddle here, and this guy's standing by it, so it must be his. If you were stopping the investigation there, then okay, well done. you miscreants, you pulled it off. But if you just take one step away from that and go, let's have everybody stand on the wall, I'm going to walk by and do a sniff test. Like, you're going to figure out your culprits fast.
Right.
Yeah. Do you have to get low for that sniff test, or do you is it just like a general vicinity sniff test?
I don't think you have to do any.
If we turn this scene into a Forensic Files episode, I want to know how deep we have to go with this.
If you're not ever leaving your desk, there's a pee aura.
Oh yeah, you can smell pee. It stinks. As Allie also mentioned, I really was like wondering what was going on with this classroom. I was like, do they only have, from what Mark just said, that they just have all the kids in one classroom and just keep rotating teachers? Mm-hmm. But like, is this a class of just anyone? Is it like, well, we need the young kids need a classroom, but also let's mix in adult education? Because one of the all of the boys look too old for high school. But one guy in particular has a 5 o'clock shadow already. And I'm like, he's 39. And I'm being generous. Like, what is he doing? He's just like, you know what? Is he doing a Billy Madison thing where he's just trying to go through the different grades in a couple weeks? Like, what's this guy's story? Because he's not at all. So many kids are older. He's way older than all of them.
And the one guy, the kid with like blonde hair and red jacket, I thought it was like, is this a telenovela thing where, yes, that's obviously an adult, but we've put him in the kid outfit and you're just going to accept him?
Exactly. Oh, that's funny.
And then let's put one 13-year-old in there just...
Just to mix it up. And like one actual child. And just to be like, it's school. Like, I was like, what's happening? Anyway, little Tita is also obsessed with Gradiska. She's a hairdresser in town and sort of the town beauty. Everyone's, you know, as soon as she walks by, whistles. She doesn't mind wiggling her butt to on almost no provocation.
Yeah.
If you can throw out a flute song...
If you put a camera right up next to someone's butt while they're walking, it's going to look wiggly.
It's very true. It's very true. Did they just
everybody
like,
knows that, Ryan?
Did they just put the camera around her waist and just said, "We're just going to get some extra foot. We're going to shoot over here. You walk around, and we're just going to get some extra B-roll here."
Oh, B-roll. I see what you did there. Bun roll.
Mark, you were going to say?
No, I was just, you said flute, and I didn't get that.
Saxophone.
Meant to drop that one in.
Yes!
Oh, darn it. Nice. Okay, that was from our last episode.
I like it. That's the fact that her name is Gradiska, and then you learn this kind of horrible town legend about how she got that nickname, and apparently she accepts it. Like, people call her that to her face. Like, I don't think Fellini, like, he clearly thinks about women a lot, but he doesn't think about them as individual human beings who might also have thoughts a lot.
Well, they do have butts and boobs, and he does consider that. He has considered that.
How much farther do you need to go? Unless it's your mom.
Speaking of his parents, Tita's father, played by Armando Brancia, who was only in minor roles up until this, and this role actually, he had a take, his career like took off after the success of this movie.
Of course.
So like, he was a guy who was didn't really turn to acting until middle age, played little roles, got this thing, his career takes off. Pretty cool thing. Tita's mother is played by Pupella Maggio, who later appeared in Cinema Paradiso. The dad has, he's definitely made fun of a lot. There's a lot of him falling down, fart jokes, a lot of stuff interrupting, but a lot of it is just him just being angry at everything. And I guess trying to, you know, again, this is based on a real guy named Tita and his dad, and just trying to talk about the outbursts.
You mean like when he shit his pants outburst?
Yeah.
I want to make sure I'm clear which outburst
for sure.
I did. That was actually one of my, not the shitting, but one of my favorite turns of the movie is this guy is kind of a buffoon or an out, you know, this guy who yells a lot. And then it turns out he's, spoiler, the only one standing up to the fascists in any way in that town. And you have to go, all right, points to dad.
And apparently that was like an actual thing that the fascists did, was they would force people who didn't go along with everything they said, and they would force them to drink castor oil. That was a real thing that they would do to dissidents. And he wasn't an active dissident. He was just somebody who didn't want to, you know, speak their praises, and that was enough for them to want to just force him to drink castor oil and shit himself.
I feel like he was the one who set up the gramophone. Am I wrong? Because if he's accusing the brother of ratting him out, what did the brother rat him out for?
No, that he was. It's the uncle. Is that that's not his brother? I think that's his wife's brother, right? The
guy
that
I was
talking
about.
Yeah. Because he's the one who is pro-fascist.
Yes.
So yes, I think that. So is that an act of anti-fascism?
Because it's playing the theme of the dissident or the anti-fascist.
Oh, okay, I see. Right.
Oh,
yeah. Okay.
Okay.
That went by me. Yeah, because I was like, if being if owning records means you're not into fascism, then I have not been into fascism for a long time, and I'm really not into it because I have so many records. So if that is what it takes, then mission accomplished on my part. But yes, you're right. It is a gramophone recording of the International. That is what he plays. And also the mom is doing the Lord's work there. Real thankless, gotta be sort of like a typical Italian mom.
Yeah, but I didn't see any spaghetti. I didn't see any pizza rolls. I didn't see like the garlic bread, you know, the one that you get in like the aluminum bag that you put in the oven and it's already pre-buttered and you just pull it out and cut. Like, I didn't see any
that
of those
garlic bread. That's the best.
That garlic bread.
Best.
Yeah.
I keep telling you how many times I've had an Italian over to dinner and tried to serve them, and they're like, "Where are the pizza rolls?" And that I hang my head in shame.
Yeah.
When I went to Italy with my family and we checked in the hotel, we said, where's a good place for pizza? And they said, rolls? I said, pizza. They pizza said, rolls.
It's rolls, yes.
Yeah.
I said, no, just pizza. They said, rolls. And I was like, oh, it is. It's
Totino.
This is what we're into.
Totino, where do you get the, where's the best place for pizza rolls? And Totino was like,
I get the pizza rolls.
You want rolls?
You want pizza rolls? Fellini. Fellini's pizza rolls.
In all seriousness, this joke is even funnier by the fact that Totino's was a real pizza place in the mecca of Italian food, the Twin Cities of Minnesota.
Oh.
That's where it legit started.
Wow.
So,
wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow. And took the Midwest by storm. During a storm, actually. People could eat nothing but pizza rolls. And they actually went, you know what? Wasn't bad. Wasn't bad. Didn't
pizza
hate it.
Pizza rolls have taken me by storm on occasion. So.
Now with extra castor oil.
Don't need it. You don't need it. Skip it. Just go right for the rolls.
In a weird twist of the moment, we're going to spoil bits of this movie, which also truly is one of those movies I don't think you can actually spoil. But his mom, like in one moment when Tita is sick and she's feeding him soup and he's being a whiny little baby about being sick, like the next scene, she's like in the hospital with something, and it's like, oh, again, the pages of the diary, you're trying to put them back together, and you're like, oh, I didn't realize, I don't think that happened this close, but here we are.
You know, it's, of course, it's snowing, and we know that we haven't got to the last season, because this is a four seasons movie, so.
Your favorite genre.
Yeah. Just saying. Was it Bess Armstrong in that movie?
Yeah.
Such a hard crush for her back then.
Not the first time you've mentioned this. This is becoming a little too constant.
Oh, that scene on the lake. Oh, man.
Oh, man. We're going to have to get a hold of Bess Armstrong just to kind of close the loop on this.
Oh, I see a cameo in my future.
Let's talk about Tita's father's brother, Uncle Teo, who they pick up one lovely afternoon because he is in an insane asylum, and they decide, let's take him out for a day in the family farm. What are they farming there?
What are they farming? You seem to be able to drop in and out very easily. Yeah.
There's still apparently a staff there?
Right.
Right. Doing what?
Why is mom having to do fucking everything back home? They're like, we do have money, but it all goes to paying for the occasion that we decide to take the car out and drive out to the country. We have to keep them employed.
Yes.
I mean, do I have that wrong? Was it they're just visiting?
No.
Where's it someone else?
They're visiting. It's they're saying it's their old farm.
Yeah.
But and then why can they be there? Yeah.
Right. And I know we're not things we love, things we hated, but they also introduce Uncle Teo like 90 minutes into the movie.
Yes.
You're like, why are we introducing this character now?
There's another a late character who comes close on the heels of Uncle Teo where you're like, what? And then gone. No lines. No.
Yeah. Oh, a lot of people come in and out. I mean, one of the characters, like Volpina, one of the characters that you learn early on, who is, I guess, the town prostitute? I don't know. They're not very clear about it, but she's clearly got problems mentally everyone's like, hey, whatever. We don't tell the blind guy what to do when he's just walking the streets. You know,
but we're gonna throw him on a boat so we can go see this ocean liner.
Right. And it's
our joke. We know he can't see it.
He won't be able to see it. He's gonna have to hang out.
Yeah.
and just, and you know he can't see, so you know he's feeling every bit of the motion sickness that's going on. Like, he is doing everything. He's holding that accordion's doing everything, because he's like, keep it together, keep it together, keep it together. Yeah. All he can do is feel, like, the ocean rocking back and forth. Oh, don't throw up, don't throw up, don't throw up. But anyway, there's lots of characters that you think are going to play a bigger role, and they really aren't. They're kind of just window dressing for the town and for each little section that we get to. It's very unusual.
It's if a Richard Scarry busy book was very lustful, you kind of get what this town is like.
Right, right. Lots of stuff.
Yes.
Wow.
And they really good. Had Wormley. Big, giant titties and sold cigarettes. Maybe he drove around in a hollowed out Marlboro box instead of that apple. Then there we go.
Yes.
Oh, by the way, Uncle Teo is played by Francesco Ciccio Ingrassia, who was a comedian in Italy. So they had him. So I think his inclusion was also just like, I'm sure to audiences in Italy, was like, hey, we got this comedian coming in here, and he's going to go literally piss himself out on the side of the road and then climb up a tree and throw rocks at people and then leave.
It's not about screaming, I want a woman, over and over and over again.
Yes, right.
His catchphrase, no doubt.
I went in the country and freed from, you know, the institution you spend most of your time at. Why not? Why not?
Why not?
It seems like he wanted a particular...
I know we're not at final questions, but I did misspeak earlier when I said Wormley. His name is Lowly, all right? His name is Lowly Worm. And I spoke too soon, and I said Wormley, and then I was immediately kicking myself, because I know in my fucking heart his name is Lowly. So, I apologize.
That was another person who was like, unsubscribe. These people do not know what they're talking about.
Dear madam,
this...
They don't know Lowly's name, and they support fascism. I'm not sure I'm down with this cut podcast.
Yeah, I don't know.
But I'm going to give him another listen just to hear him out.
It would people that are into fascism would just breeze through a Richard Scarry book. Just breeze right through and not even take note of the characters' names. Jeez. So we've done Uncle Teo. One other thing that I'm just curious about is the Grand Hotel part. Now, in this book that I got, there was something to the Grand Hotel that really fascinated Fellini, and the Grand Hotel in Rimini. But why is this section in the movie? I know it's something he was fascinated by. I'm happy he was able to explore that. As an audience member, removed from Fellini, and I'm not him, why does this scene exist? What happens in it? Talk about somebody who's introduced into the movie, this guy with this white streak of hair who asks another busty woman to take a dance, and then both these characters dance away from the film.
Mm-hmm. What? No, I think he comes back for 1 second to say that she gave him posterior intimacy.
Oh, you're right.
Which, that's... on paper, it sounds better than butt fucking.
But right, right, right.
But I think it's actually grosser to say posterior intimacy.
You have to think your A to Z on that one is so long. It's so protracted. I'm sorry for using that word. It just doesn't feel right. But... you have to go so far to go, what's a nicer way of putting this? And it's like, just say that. Just say what it is. We can skip how creepy this is.
Oh, so
when you try to put that into a clever way, it just ends up, you end up sounding like, I don't know, like Hannibal Lecter or something. It's just like, no, just say it. Don't say it like that. That creeps me out.
Mm-mm.
Were they not on the boat? Were they not? On the boat later? Am I confusing those two
maybe.
With somebody else?
No, maybe they. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I remember the photographer who seems to be everywhere taking a picture of two. They brought the photographer. He brought that expensive ass camera out in the onto the sea at night. Because he takes a picture of a couple on the boat, but maybe it's not them. Maybe I was just confusing them.
I think it could be
with
them.
Another couple.
I think it's like, you know, it's this extravagance, and yes, maybe the people that came on the boat then got on the boat and left, and later on they go to the Grand Hotel and it's all boarded up and they dance in front of it regardless. Mm-hmm. So I know that that was part of the problem with Rimini when Fellini came back after World War II, because it had been bombed so much that a lot of what was there before in his memory was no longer existed, and it was being rebuilt, but rebuilt in a new, entirely new way, and not how it was. So, you know, maybe that he had that kind of feeling about it. Maybe that's what it was about for him.
Rimini was also being rebuilt very slowly because they stopped stopping. They kept stopping to write poems. And
right.
Just. So, forever.
Forever.
Hey. Whoa, the inspiration strikes. Totino, where are those pizza rolls? I've got some inspiration.
Keep them coming, Totino.
We do end with a big race, an annual car race, which is, I guess, as Mark said, is it only a single car that they raced?
It's the same car.
They're just watching one person race. And not one, but two people are so inspired that they have dream sequences about themselves being the great racer.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Two people.
Mm-hmm. Two people.
So many dream sequences.
One of them is Tita, which makes sense. The other one's like his other buddy, who has this also fantasy sequence where he's like part of the fascist youth movement, and they're in front of this giant flower arrangement that makes Mussolini's head, and he's thinking, which I thought was very appropriate, he's thinking, what if this girl likes me? Because he's like, he could care less really about what he's doing. He's really just, how do I... But then by the end of the film, he's like, forget that girl, because now I race cars. I'm like, this poor guy is so confused. What has happened? What ride has that guy been on?
It is, he wants the girl, and then I guess his arc is, I don't need that girl.
I have fast car, no need girl now.
Yeah, because he's
also
found love.
He has no fast car in reality. This is all fantasy. You could do whatever you wanted. It's all made up in your mind. But Erica, I think it's that time.
Oh. It's time for things we loved and things we hated. Hated them.
Okay, we're going to talk about the things we love and things we hate about
Amarcord.
Mark, what did you love?
Oh, boy, that's a tough one. I will say this. This movie is shot very well, and I know that's an easy out, and we've used that on many a movie that we were like, eh. But it's beautifully shot, and I'll give it
beautiful.
That.
Beautiful.
It looks beautiful. That's all I got.
It is beautifully, it's gorgeously shot. It does look amazing. It's very well staged, and it does, obviously, it's been a big influence on lots of movies. It's like, catching up with the movie now, you're like, we've been living in, like, all the people that were inspired by it, you know?
Like, yeah, like, the opening scene of Disney's Beauty and the Beast, I'm like, oh.
Right. Yeah, there's so much, and, you know.
Crazy villagers, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep.
And,
yep.
Like, as Erica was pointing out, like, Wes Anderson's, the majority of his career, at least,
oh,
you know,
yeah.
Basically around Royal Tenenbaums onward. Allie, what did you love about
Amarcord?
I can pick two things, actually. One of them is that he does use extras who look like real people in a small town. Like, if this were mm-hmm. shot by Americans, mm-hmm. everyone would be hot.
Mm-hmm. That was the thing with Fellini, was he was obsessed with using actors who were not actors.
Yes.
Another thing that Wes Anderson does.
Yes.
But continue, I'm sorry.
And I did like the sequences where you get the humanity of, like, Tita's dad wants to go yell at the fascists, but it turns out his mom has locked him in. Mm-hmm. And then later when he comes down the street, having been forced to shit himself, she does, like, there is a moment of real care there where she comes to get him and help him out. I'm like, okay, those are, all right, you got me, Fellini. That's...
And I think the dad has like a real like moment, like where he's just kind of like, when he's sitting at the table in the kitchen, like that's a heartbreaker, you know? Mm-hmm. He like doesn't know what to do himself, you know?
Yeah.
Erica, what did you love?
This movie really tricked me because I would never seek this out if I didn't have to watch this for our podcast. This isn't one where I'd be like, let me just flip through the old Fellini files and Emma Cord. I don't think I would have.
The Fellini files are filled with people who just love butts.
Yeah. So that's what I'm looking for. I'm in there searching for butts. Good butt flick.
Yeah, sure.
You could do worse if you're searching for butts.
Yeah, it's true.
You were going to get them, for sure.
Could be a real shit show. I don't...
No pun intended.
No pun intended. I don't think I would have watched this otherwise. It isn't, you know, a movie that I knew existed, nor would I have looked up to watch. And something about it just pulled me in. I don't want to say I loved it. I definitely didn't hate it. But it kept me interested. And I watched through it. And I think it was just random and chaotic and messy enough that it really... kept me entertained, and kind of then when it was over, I was like, oh yeah, and it made me think about my own, you know, my own upbringing in a small town, and you know, some of the parallels and some of the differences. So I don't know, love is a strong word, and I don't like to give it out willy nilly, but overall, it surprised me that I did enjoy it.
You're allowed to. Well, to enjoy it.
Yeah, maybe that's, yeah, that's those okay.
Giant titties talking, but you know, I liked it.
I didn't hate it either. It's a lot to take in. It's a lot. I feel like I watched it almost two full times plus a time with the commentary, and it's just I'm still figuring it out. I mean, there's a lot to parse in there.
You watched it. And I saw or overheard in the commentary when you had the commentary on that it was Fellini's, you know, remembrance and sort of like his memories of growing up there. That helped me a great deal. I think had I gone into this not knowing that, I would have been like, what is this? What is happening? So knowing that's what it was helped me out a great deal. If that's helpful to you, dear listener, before you give it a little once over.
And it definitely plays like that, and it is beautiful to look at, and there's a couple sequences I think are great. I love the snow sequence. I think a lot of that's very cool. There's some really, really well shot stuff, and beginning on early on in the movie, there was a lot of it that Mark talked about with the farts and the jokes, and I was starting to think this is a sketch film because we were going through, and I was like, is this like a classy Italian Porky's or Screwballs?
Yeah.
And because it was...
That's where it's important to know this was memories.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. That's where the knowing
it,
that comes
It had a shot to be just that, and... you know, whether or not, if that's what you were looking for, you get at least a taste of that. You get a couple of those Totino's pizza rolls that taste like screwballs. Let's switch to things we hated. Mark, what did you hate?
Rex Reed calls it a classy Porky's.
Yeah. That sounds appropriate to Rex Reed. That's what he would say. That's what
he would say. Yeah, that probably. Erica, I do agree, just really quickly before, what, is it Things I Hated? Is that where we're at? Yeah, okay.
That's where we're at, yes.
But I do agree that going into this, it was surreal enough and kind of, there's so many different characters, so many different things going on that I thought, is this going to be like Subway to the Stars where we get a back-to-back movie where I'm like, hey, I don't know what the heck is going on with this one, but I'm in. It just, if there was just a plot,
Just a little bit of one.
Just a little bit. Mm-hmm. It would have really helped me out.
Yeah.
And things we hated.
Or just more of that narrator. He kind of
pops in and out,
but he's not consistently all the way through it. Just pop him in.
Completely agree.
Every now and then, a little bit more would have been perfect.
And have him be less concerned with the town's history and give us a little bit more of like what's going on in town.
Mm-hmm.
Would have been it would have helped.
Yeah,
and also maybe don't delegate all your narration duties to other people to the point that at some point I'm like, wait, are you talking to me? Or are you talking to people on the screen? I'm a little...
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you're talking to me. Oh, I should be paying attention to this.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are multiple times that people talk to the screen that you're not expecting them to. And then you're like, oh, that's what we're doing now. I'll be really quick. Thing I hated, the Tio thing, just because we introduced a new character for like 20 minutes, way too late in the movie, and that character never comes back. And I'm like, why did we have to do that? That was not necessary.
Yeah. Mm. Yes. Hmm. Allie, what did you hate?
Before I say what I hated, I need to shout out to Stuart Ranson, who used to refer to the Clark 22 bus in Chicago as the Fellini Express, which
which shouts to Stuart
multiple times during the course. Stuart was right. I hate it. So I had a hard time getting in because like one of the first things in the movie is, wasn't it funny when we were mean to the blind man?
Like,
But what I hated was in the Tio sequence, he's in the tree and then they're like, look, a dwarf nun will get him down. Which I was like, fuck you. You're just being... Look how arty I am. Look how arty and bizarre. Fuck you. Fuck you for introducing that in this useless sequence for no reason and never referring to it again. Fuck you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's slow clap worthy.
This was the good movie, Allie. I hated
that moment in that sequence.
I'm going to have to go back to movies like The Funny Farm and just The Oldest Profession.
I ruined my shot.
I thought it was, you were going to be like, finally, real cinema. we rolled the dice. You know, you rolled the dice. Erica, what did you hate?
I mentioned it a little bit when Mark was bringing up what he hated, which was just for me, I just needed a little bit more hand-holding through all of this, so I could have used more of the narrator just flash the year. What year is it? What season is it? The season you could eventually figure out, you know, if it was snowing, obviously, or there were the puffballs in the air, but... I just needed more. I'm just a dumb lady who watches movies to see boobies. So, you know, I needed a little bit more.
You needed a little
bit more help.
Some more guardrails for you. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I don't have a refined palate. So, you know.
I think we're all.
Just need a little more hand-holding.
We're all sort of the same mind just a little bit. Me, this just had too many characters. I mean, a surefire winner for the worldie next year for a film with too many characters. Yeah. This has too many characters. And I know that even like there's an extra scene in on the Blu-ray. Some of the characters that are like sitting by the fire and they're supposed to represent the old guard, the guard that was there before fascism took over of Italy. And they're supposed to represent that. There's extra scenes with them. It's like he shot extra scenes with Gradisca that he talks about. Mm-hmm. A scene that he cut out from Gradisca. He was an actress. She was, I don't know if I mentioned before who she was, but she had worked with Fellini before, Magali Noel, who is a French actress, and she'd worked on La Dolce Vita. And he cast her at the last minute. He had somebody else in mind who didn't want to do it, so... He brought her on and said she was a joy to work with and she would do anything. Well, she shot a scene where actually she got naked for the movie, but he cut that scene out. And then he cut like another scene of hers, which was like her favorite scene.
Not enough butt.
Right.
Not enough butt, probably. Had to go.
Yeah. Which is like, in this movie, surprising that he actually had nudity and he actually, you know, cut it out.
Yeah.
But then another scene where she had like a real big tracking shot up to her, and it was this big moment with her, and he cut that out. So I think she was disappointed by it. In any case, but let's go to our favorite scene. Mark, what was your favorite scene?
I'm going to go ahead and say that it was, it's when they all go out on the ships, and I mean, they're going to, first of all, they're all heading out on different boats. Some are more, I guess, maybe yacht size. Some of them are much smaller boats. And they don't explain why. Because why explain it to you, as we've already covered? Like, the one thing Wes Anderson learned was maybe we put title cards in between to kind of explain what's happening in this movie.
Right.
But
right.
In this movie, you don't get those. So they head out, and you discover later on that they're there to see this Italian cruise liner that is going to be driving by in front of their town, their seaside town. And I thought that was just really cool. Like, first of all, how they didn't get run over by the cruise liner, mystery to me.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Very dangerous.
They put themselves in. They had no lights.
Very dangerous. And
have been in a cruise liner that almost ran over a small boat, and it's not.
Yeah, you should not be that close. Yeah. And those are like not. Yeah. They were like rowboats. Like they were like you should.
Yeah.
You are the wake that's going to come by. Very dangerous. Why you didn't? Some of those boats had to have just tipped over. I mean, not good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. It's kind of shocking that they didn't at the very least. Have the wake knock them over, but it was also based on a real boat that was built in, like, the first launch was in 1931.
The SS like Rex, I believe. Yeah,
was an actual cruise liner. So it was like, I don't know. I liked that whole scene because I had a reason to care, because they're out all doing something, and I'm like, what are you doing? And then the payoff was kind of cool, seeing this cruise liner. And them not all being run over and killed by the cruise liner, which was also kind of nice.
Yeah.
It would have cut maybe 15 minutes off the movie, so.
It would have. And it's also my favorite scene, too. There's something about that when you're, like, in this small town and you just see something that big and decadent. And you're just like, that they literally go out into the water and wait forever for it to come by. The whole thing was like, remember the day we all just took these rowboats out in the middle of the water and just watched a boat go by? That's how much they're like.
They wave to it, and like Gradiska's like blowing kisses and crying. Right. Like they're very emotional about seeing it.
Very authentically. Like my hometown is quite small, and there was a point when there was big construction happening, and people would just go look at the hole.
Let's
go check it out. Check out the hole. See how the hole's doing.
So I'm like, yeah, I get this. I understand.
Yeah. Totally. And again, I agree that the kids were very mean to the blind guy in the beginning, but kids, I think, you know, to Fellini's eyes, you know, he's as quick to judge certain characters as he is kids, where he's like, kids are just the worst. They're just shit.
Kids are the worst,
But meaner than that to the blind guys, to take him out into the middle of the ocean to see something he cannot see. That is one of the more cruel things you could have done.
I think he wanted to go and then thought someone would fill him in on what it
looks like. Well, he does say, like, tell me what it looks like, and no one will.
Nobody
does. I'm like, that's the cruelty.
No one
tells
him.
That's cruelty. Yeah. Erica, your favorite scene?
I liked that one as well. I also, I kind of have two that are tied, I guess, in my mind. Join me, won't you? Follow me. Let's just take a little trip through Erica's mind. Was when all the boys, when it's foggy out, we're kind of in fog sequence.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And go to the hotel and it's closed maybe for the season or permanently. It's hard to tell. And they start to just dance. Like one of them, I think Tita starts to dance, like mime that he's like dancing inside the hotel. And then each one just does something different. Like one plays the drums, one's like miming, playing like a stand up bass or something like that. And I don't know, just like that moment where they all kind of just pretended they were there, because they're a little bit too old for that at this point, for that kind of like make-believe and pretend, but they just sort of had that moment in the fog, like pretending that they were at the hotel and what they would do. Would they be in the band or they'd be, you know, dancing? I thought that was really, you know, kind of sweet, like kind of cute and kind of sweet and sad. So yeah, I liked that scene.
Considering what they usually do together, I thought, you know, yeah, that was mm-hmm. that was wholesome. Really
downright wholesome. Yeah, nobody had their wiener out. Yeah,
Fellini cut the scene where they then just quickly got in a circle and just rubbed one out.
Yeah,
so
they didn't.
Like, that was another. There was a big tracking shot. It was beautifully shot, but you know, he cut it for time.
They banged the shit out of that hotel keyhole.
It'll never be the same again.
Oh no!
What is this keyhole is really gummed up? What is in here?
Oh. We're gonna have to just cut the lock.
Sticky.
I'm sorry.
All right, let's jump to some research here real quick. Despite basing this film on his childhood in Rimini, as we've talked about, he did not shoot the film there. He explained, actually, to Chandler in her book, he says, I don't like to go back to Rimini. When I do go back, I am assailed by ghosts. The reality goes to war with the world of my imagination. For me, the real Rimini is the one in my head. I could have gone back there to film for Amacord, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. The Rimini I could recreate was closer to the reality of my memory. Instead, they built the town in Cinecittà Studios in Rome, where he can continue to live in Rome. As he told the Chronicle News Service in 1973, he says, quote, at the studio, you can build total environment, express precisely effect you seek, multiply it if you want, and give it poetic value. It was something I actually wondered around the time when they have the snow sequence, because I was like, this is either like total kismet that they happen to be in this town, or like they've built this town inside a studio. Which is amazing, I think, that they did that, because looks really good. And obviously they do have some stuff. They shot along close to Rimini, I think, along the coast, because they do have some shots that are outside. But the rest is in the studio. They even built the water in the sequence that we're talking about, where they see the boat. The boat, I believe, itself is also like a practical painting with smoke coming out of it. Mm-hmm. So, and he said, quote, we made the water, he says, we made it with plastic leaves and artificial fog. You may not find fish in it, but you will believe they are there.
Yeah, it looks really good. I mean, it does look like a matte painting, but as a fan of early John Carpenter movies and such, I love like a good fake background.
Yeah, honestly, it works. I mean, that stuff works.
Like, to me, like, that's an oversized memory of, like, you've told the story so many times that it's never gonna, like, I bought that.
I think it plays really well in the scene. There's another reason why Fellini wanted to avoid shooting his real hometown, and that's because he wanted to avoid people thinking the movie was autobiographical and inadvertently hurt people from, you know, that he grew up with in the town of Rimini. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that had some reality, as UPI reported. Fellini was sued by a housewife in Rimini, Italy, who filed a damage suit against Fellini because there was a prostitute in Fellini's movie that bore the same name as hers, Gradisca. Gradisca Mori, 59, said in her suit she was the only Rimini woman named after the World War I battlefield of Gradisca. However, Fellini said in Rome that he'd never met Mrs. Mori, and he said the film's character was entirely fictional and was not a prostitute but a hairdresser. So probably got that thrown out during discovery. Anyway, the filming of this ends in July 1973. They built all these sets after 24 weeks of shooting. Though Fellini has said that the start of the filming actually got delayed for 2 weeks because he had the flu. And, you know, as we saw in Tita, you know, Fellini, he takes a long time getting better from the flu. Come on. Yes. There, you're just going to have to bring the bowl up to his lips. He's just under all those covers. It's too hot. Where's Totino with my pizza rolls?
Don't microwave them in the oven.
Oh, when the corner opens up and it just oozes out just a little bit, it is the best. All right.
Oh, it burned my lip.
We're all doing the worst Italian accents. So there's 2 weeks that he had the flu, but also he had to deal with strikes from the crew. So they lost around 20 full days because of different crew strikes, which were all very frustrating for Fellini, and I imagine the crew, who probably were pissed off at what they were getting paid. But anyway, speaking of what the budget was, the budget of the film was reportedly about $3.5 million, Fellini's most expensive movie to date. While the movie opened in Italy in December 1973, it played out of competition at Cannes in May of 1974, and that is where New World picked it up, though it wasn't as easy to pick up as New World's Frank Moreno told the LA Times in June of 1974. He said, "We started negotiations for the new Fellini film, Amarcord, but the prices they were asking were not realistic. They wanted $400,000. We were prepared to pay $250,000 at the time, but they still insisted on $400,000. Well, not too many Fellini films have shown a profit over here to justify that cost." We've covered this, as particularly when we did Cries and Whispers, Whispers and Cries, and also an article that's on our website where we talk about how Corman got into releasing foreign films. But at the time, the foreign film market in the 1970s was at its lowest, which is also how Corman, you know, benefited because everything was very cheap. We also talked about on Tin Drum that the people that were selling Tin Drum rights were also trying to get a lot of money for Tin Drum. So yeah, they had to get things at a certain cost. So even though the movie's $3 million, they're just going to get they wanted to pay $250,000. They're going to recoup their cost that way. Though that said, this was a huge success for New World. So they do begin releasing the movie in September of 1974. It's very hard to find box office numbers, but I know Corman has said that this was probably the most successful movie he had. And this was coming off of the fact that he had done in 1972, they had released Cries and Whispers, and that was a big success. But Fellini was even, probably, he said, his biggest success as a foreign film acquisition. Following Amarcord, Fellini only made 7 more films. He had had quite a run leading up to, his last being 1990's The Voice of the Moon. And the film, yes, Mark, did win an Oscar. It was nominated for a few Oscars, winning the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film for 1974, and then was nominated for Best Director and Best Screenplay the following year because it played as a foreign film before and then played in had America. So it got in there twice. It was the 4th career Oscar win for Fellini and his last before receiving a Lifetime Achievement Oscar in 1993. Who called Fellini to give him the news of his Lifetime Achievement? That would be Robert Remy, the former head of New World in the 1980s, who was then president of the Academy. In Fellini's speech at the Academy Awards, he thanked his wife, actress Giulietta Masina, and told her, "And please stop crying," at the end of the award. And the camera cut to her, and of course she was crying. Both Fellini and Giulietta were not well at the time. And Fellini debated whether or not he was actually going to travel to America. He did not like to travel at all, particularly as he got older. And he was not well, so he didn't really want to travel. He eventually was convinced to do so because he thought it was a point of national pride to go and get this Lifetime Achievement Award for Italy. And his wife was also encouraging him to go as well. Fellini would pass away 6 months later after receiving this award. And his wife would pass 5 months after that. So in Italy, when people mention Fellini, they often say, "Don't cry, Giulietta." So that's one thing that they say whenever Fellini's mentioned. But let's end with Roger Corman's words about Amarcord from the book The Movie World of Roger Corman. He says, "Amarcord is one of the finest films we ever distributed. I consider it to be one of the 2 or 3 best films Fellini has ever made." It's not the best, but it's close.
Yeah. Jury's not out on that one. Give it time.
Yeah. I mean, it's not better than 8.5. Calm down. it was nominated for 3 Academy Awards and 1 for Best Foreign Film. It was just a good experience all around and a pleasure working with Fellini, who was extremely cooperative. He came to New York and made publicity appearances for us. He worked with us in a very friendly way. Again, with the film, we got a great deal of commercial success as well as critical acclaim. And that, together with Cries and Whispers, is the biggest commercial success we've ever had in the art film realm. And that is it. That is
Amarcord.
Amarcord.
Well, that is it for the spring recording the spring session our episode on Amarcord. Then we're going to take a brief pause and we'll start the summer. Summer and then winter and then fall.
Could you have a violin theme that just plays over and over and over and over and over and over?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. And I get it, listeners. You're thinking, how can they talk about this movie four more times? Trust us when we tell you, we can.
There's so much we didn't talk about.
We scratched the surface on this movie.
Yeah. So we're all just going to talk about what we remember from the previous time that we talked. Our own retelling of it. Yes. So it's going to be magical. It's going to be one of the top two or three episodes that we've recorded. Not the best one, but like
but pretty up top. There. Pretty top. It's up there.
Pretty top. Pretty
one
top.
Of the top two or three movies that you've had me watch for this.
Yes.
That Fellini doesn't quite beat some of the masterful cinema we've had you watch.
Be the Big Birdcage. Come on.
Yeah. Oh. Cover Girl models? Come on. It's very hard to beat that. Allie, thank you so much for joining us yet again.
Thank you for having me.
Yes, oh,
so great
you.
Having you. Is there anything you need, you'd like to plug? Where can people find you? Do you want them to find you? You want to just be left alone?
You can find me playing with Dam, but our theater is under renovations right now. So back in March at some point. Yes.
Okay, great. Yes, Eric and I have gone to see that show. It is terrific. Definitely, if you're in the LA area, head out to the Valley and go see that. See some good improv. You were guaranteed to see good improv. And so that's really something. If you've seen improv, if you've seen enough improv to know you're going to get a good improv show is really a good treat. So that's definitely something to see. And thank you again for joining us. If you want to hear any of the episodes that Allie has been on before, which there has been a bunch, go to our website, newworldpicturespodcast.com. And that's where you can listen to all of our episodes. You can read that article I discussed earlier. You can buy a t-shirt. Buy a t-shirt. It helps support the show. Write us a 5-star review if you like. If you dare. I dare you to do both of those things. I dare you. And we'll see you next time on the New World Pictures Podcast, a part of Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network. Bye, everybody.
Amarcord.
Thank you for listening. To hear more shows from the Someone's Favorite Productions Podcast Network, please select the link in the description.
Are you a film fan who loves the ultimate home video experience? Look no further than The Disconnected. Your host, Ryan Verrill, is your go-to source for the latest and most accurate information on home video releases, exclusive interviews with industry insiders and filmmakers, and has established a thriving community where every film and physical media enthusiast feels welcome. From hidden gems to blockbuster hits, The Disconnected brings you insider knowledge and a welcoming space to share your love of cinema. Watch every Thursday night at 9:30 Eastern, 6:30 Pacific for the live announcements show and follow The Disconnected on social media to stay updated. Subscribe to The Disconnected on YouTube or on the podcast provider of your choice and dive into a world where every movie night is an adventure.